you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Ryan Dawson back on the show. Of course, Ryan is a historian, researcher, done a lot of work on some of the controversial issues of our day and also historical issues, 9/11, the JFK assassination, the Zionist lobby, its influence, well, in the United States and throughout the world. Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, the Zionist lobby and its influence into dragging us into wars in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're the one, you do meticulous research. You name names, make these connections. So your research is very important in this, in really clarifying this issue and putting it in terms that we can talk about it.
It's important to say something beside other than some vague term like NWO or elite or deep state or, you know, get to the names, right?
Yeah.
And why not?
And tonight, or actually for you, it's the night. To me, it's the morning because you're way over there on the other side of the world in Japan.
In the future.
Yeah, in the future, yes. Can you give any stock tips? the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, we just observed the 50th anniversary of that. And, of course, on June 5th, 1968, 42-year-old presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy was mortally wounded shortly after midnight at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Of course, he just won the presidential primary, beating Eugene McCarthy. And, of course, he was on his way to Chicago. And I think his last words were, public words at least, were, now let's go on to Chicago and let's win there. But he was shot dead, allegedly, by Sirhan Sirhan, a lone nut assassin, driven mad by Senator Kennedy's pro-Israeli policies. That's the official narrative. Of course, Sirhan Sirhan himself was convicted of that murder the following year, I think in April 1969. His sentence was commuted in 1972 when the death penalty was declared unconstitutional by the California Supreme Court. And he's been denied parole 15 times. He's still in prison, languishing in prison for that murder. First, Ryan, that assassination, I guess we'll briefly go over, what's the problems with the official narrative of that assassination? I know I'm familiar with them, but it's for the benefit of our audience. What do you see as the biggest problems with the official narrative as Sirhan Sirhan being the lone nut assassin?
There's a lot of problems with it. Sirhan Sirhan was a Palestinian Christian. I think we should mention that. So that him being a Palestinian is why they gave his motivations were supposedly because of Robert Kennedy's support for Israel, which is ironic since he's The Kennedys supported Palestinian right of return, and it was Robert Kennedy himself that was pushing to inspect Dimona for nuclear weapons, supported Algerian independence. I mean, the Israelis hated the Kennedys. But the problems with it, he was definitely there and he definitely had a gun, so it seems like a closed case. Here's a guy hiding in the kitchen. Somehow he knew he was going to exit through the kitchen with a gun. He fired it. It was witnessed by, you know, everyone who was there. John Pilger was there, in fact. And so it seems like, well, that should be it. The thing is, his gun only held 8 bullets and there were 13 shots. He hit 5 people. And then Kennedy was hit 3 times. And actually his jacket had a hole through it as well. There's a bullet in the ceiling, but then there's a couple more bullets embedded in the door, and this has all been gone through with the forensic evidence with the police, etc., that there are at least 13 shots. There's acoustic evidence of that as well. But what they're saying there is they can hear 13 shots, and then after that, all the screams and stuff from the crowd make it, you know, unintelligible, so you can't tell if there are any more after that. It may have been even more than that. And an 8-shot revolver, 22 caliber, cannot fire that many times. Then you look at the coroner evidence and the police examiner's evidence of Robert Kennedy himself, and he had powder burn marks on his head. And so he was shot, the fatal shot under his right ear was from inches away. And you have witnesses who saw a man behind Kennedy with his gun drawn and firing it. So, I mean, that's pretty condemning evidence. And then when you start really looking into the case, you understand why there's a cover-up and who actually shot him, and that Sirhan Sirhan was not a lone gunman and may have been drugged out of his mind on top of that.
So it's you would say it's sort of a torn out of the page of kind of the MKUltra patsy assassin set up to go there and fire a gun off and have someone else to, you know, deliver the coup de grace, so to speak. Kind of like we saw, and then if you're familiar with the movie The Parallax View.
No, I haven't. Well, what's that?
It's a 1974 classic what's his name? I forget the actor's name. You know, he's a it involves about a company called the Parallax Corporation, very close to Permanex, and it's they hire you know, it's one of these secretive contracting agencies, you know, and they do personality profiles on vulnerable people. They hire them. And they show up to political events and just fire guns off, and then they have, you know, real assassins are taken away. So it's the Parallax View, 1974, a Warren Beatty movie. Warren Beatty. So I highly recommend.
What it reminds me of is an event in history, which was the assassination of the mayor of Chicago named Anton Cermak, and that was in 1931, and the mob killed him. But what they did is they had one person shoot into the crowd and shooting at the mayor, but the his gun, I think it was a 35 caliber, but the mayor was actually killed by a 45 caliber. So a second shooter during all the chaos of this open shooting actually did the kill shot and walked away. And this mayor of Chicago, by the way, Anton Cermak, was his mission was to drive the mob out of Chicago. So of course they had him killed. But their tactic was one person sort of publicly firing and drawing all the attention, and the one that's going to get arrested, but another person that makes sure the fatal shot goes through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
now,
yeah,
with Kennedy, they all used 22 caliber shells, but the ballistics didn't match from the bullets pulled out of the door and the ones pulled out of Kennedy's body. The only thing they had in common were being the same caliber. It just didn't match it could not have been fired from the same gun.
That's right. In fact, the bullets weren't matched to the gun. I think in court, they never introduced the murder weapon, right? There's whole problems with the chain of custody with evidence and marking the bullets. Real sloppy, you know, conveniently sloppy investigation. And another thing that's always bothered me, you know, with his lawyer, Grant Cooper.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Grant Cooper was a lawyer for the mafia as well. And, you know, Cooper's was also at the same time that Sirhan Sirhan's trial is going on, Cooper was representing co-defendants of Johnny Roselli, who had this card cheating gambling scam that they were doing. And 4 of them got convicted, by the way.
Yeah, this was the Friars case, right?
Yeah, from the Friars casino. Glad you know that. And actually, in 1969, Cooper got convicted himself. I mean, this is only a year later. He got convicted of accessory crime because he had somehow obtained unauthorized possession of secret grand jury testimony against his mafia clients. And he admitted, I mean, obviously he had gotten it, but then he never said, okay, well, how did you get that grand jury testimony? He never revealed his source. So he gets convicted for illegally trying to defend these mafia cohorts of Roselli. Roselli, by the way, was murdered right after the House Senate Selection Committee on Assassinations had had him testify, and he gets I think he got cut up in drums in Florida, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or was he shot in the mouth?
Yeah, they found him flooding in the bay there, yeah. And Giacondo was the one that got shot in the mouth, right?
Right, Giacondo got shot in the mouth to say shut up. So, yeah, Roselli was floating. And Roselli had said before, I mean, he had told people already about them bragging about killing the Kennedys before it happened. And that's actually the case for Robert Kennedy, too, when there's a character in Gotham. I don't know if you've seen the Gotham TV series.
No, I haven't.
Anyway, they have some mafiosos in season one, and one of them's named Carmine Falcone. And he's in, like, his rival gang is Maloney or whatever. But Carmine Falcone is Carmine Galante. And Carmine Galante was in prison at the time of Robert's assassination, but he was sort of the prison mob boss. And Hoffa would visit him there down in Lewisburg all the time, and they were actually witnessed talking about a contract killing for Robert Kennedy, and that was in May of 1968. And because something else interesting happened in May, Robert had always left his brother's death alone because he was so distraught. And he told friends that, yeah, he kind of suspected Hoffa or something, but he just accepted what the Warren Commission whatever they had to say, because he couldn't deal with it emotionally. But a year before he died, he sent an aide down to talk to Garrison in Louisiana. And then a week before he died in May of 1968, he spent 2 hours in Oxnard, California, checking on a reported lead into his brother's death. And then within 7 days, he was shot himself. So he was looking into his brother's assassination, and he had sent aides down to talk to Garrison, not knowing yet how tied up Garrison was with the Michello brothers, but he was starting to figure it out.
Now,
but this Carmine Galante guy, he was an underboss for the Bonanno Syndicate in New York.
Mm-hmm.
If people don't know, there's the Giovesis, or Genovesi, some people say, and the Gambino and Bonanno, maybe Lucchese. There's at that time period, they were the five points of what becomes what some people call Cosa Nostra.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's an FBI term, really, in a Hollywood thing. But
yeah, was it the RR thing or something? Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I in my opinion, Lansky was the man, but not even Luciano. I mean, Luciano was the muscle in the face and all, but Lansky's the one that really got all the real estate deals and all this. But the other man in the West Coast was John Alessio, no doubt. I mean, they had the first U.S. National Bank of San Diego. And that's where the major money laundering, like when Hoffa was getting the pension fund money to pay for Vegas casinos and hotels and things,
mm-hmm.
They're getting these loans and money laundered through this bank. And John Alessio was made a director of it. And later on, you'll see all these Nixon cronies and stuff. I mean, the bank got busted in 1973. You should look that up. It went under because of all the corruption, and they were missing like $200 million. I mean, which is a lot of money even now. But that was the like the mafia's crown jewel on the West Coast.
This factored into Hoffa's early release?
Yeah, actually, they procured the money for that.
Mm-hmm.
It was two installments of $500,000 to get, because Nixon commuted Hoffa's sentence. He's supposed to be in the pen for 13 years. I think he served a little under five and got right out. And that was inexcusable, you know. But one of Nixon's worst pardons was Angelita DiCarlo, who personally killed at least 12 people. And he was a guy He was a hitman and a debt collector, you could say. A debt collector, that's a polite way of saying it. Tortured people. I mean, tortured people. And gave people beatings, shootings, hangings, killed them with arsenic, all that. He was the worse than the Iceman. And they just pardoned him. Like, Nixon pardoned an actual serial killer. And you don't see the criticism for Nixon on that. You'll get Watergate, Vietnam, blah, blah, blah. Like, pardoning a serial killer that definitely worked for the New York mob syndicate, not a big deal.
Yeah, this is that that whole thing going beneath the surface with the Kruger's book covers and the Great Cocaine Coup, I think it's called. No, Heroin Coup, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Where Nixon is trying to take over the drug war. Is it Doug Valentine or is it the... Daniel Hopsiger, I think he traces a lot of the payments to the Watergate burglars from heroin money. And so this is the scene, you know, the whole intrigue going on, you know, several layers beneath the surface that might give us a full explanation for things like Watergate and, you know.
Well, that was Bonanno, too, because Bonanno was, they were the ones shipping, getting all this heroin in Canada and then sliding it down to New York, etc. And they had operatives busted in that. They were constantly moving the heroin from Canada down to the New York, New Jersey syndicates. Because the Bonanno's, like Joe, he gets exiled. And Carmine was his underboss. He ends up becoming the boss when he gets out of jail. But because what was special about Carmine was he had the zips, which I don't say that word, but it's kind of a derogatory term for Sicilians and Italians that are fresh off the boat. But he would use these zips as, you know, just expendable hitmen and things.
Yeah.
And just tying it back to Gotham for people who like pop culture. Carmine Falcone, the fictional character, has a hitman named Zaz, which is like his zip. But controlling the zips was important because even from jail, he was like the kingpin. Even from jail, he had a lot of sway and knew a lot of these contract killers. And so Hoffa, who's a Chicago guy, you know, is still willing to work with Carmine. This is how badly they all had interest in getting rid of RFK, especially when he started investigating his brother's death. But more so, too, they did not want him to become president because he had been prosecuting them.
Yeah.
That's why Hoffa was in jail. Would be later.
Yeah, we have this famous videotape of him needling Hoffa, saying exactly
why you girl. Why you giggling. he asked Sam Giancana, I thought only girls giggle. he deported Carlos Marcello to Guatemala.
that's right and he was the one who was exporting the Carcano rifles to Argentina, right? The special,
well, him and Joe, his brother, was doing, I think Joe Marcella, I think Carlos gets credit for everything him and his brothers did. He just gets it all, right?
Yeah.
But you find that often in mafia research. So there's sort of some unknown dude or some limo driver, and then a decade later you find out actually he was the guy, and he was more than willing to dump all the credit onto someone else.
Yeah. They're the successful mobsters, the high-profile ones.
Exactly. Like that when, Johnny Gambino, like he was nothing compared to some of the guys that were quiet that they're finding out now, you know?
Yeah, they live in small houses. And
the gas gambit they had in Jersey all through the 80s? I mean, anyway, that's not RFK stuff, but it relates to how the mob works, because you'll get these sort of iconic figures, Al Capone for running the alcohol and things like that, that are, you'll see them in like Bugs Bunny cartoons and things like that. But I think Carmine was in the Doonesbury cartoons. They called him the cigar because he basically always had a cigar. He was like a Batman villain for real, just like a cigar everywhere I go. And they all knew that he ran the zips, and he was the underboss for the Bonanno family that was running in heroin, and they needed that black market heroin to pay for all kinds of stuff. But, you know, Bonanno and them had kind of been pushed out by Giavesi and the outfit in Chicago, who were really running the pension funds from the Teamsters and these real estate deals under Lansky and the casinos in Vegas, the big league deals. And so the Bonannos were focusing on narcotics, and the Southerners were doing the same thing, Traficante and Marcello and the rest of them, because that became a booming market from the South. And actually, prior to Marcello running Louisiana, it was with under Sammy Corona, was Sammy Corolla, Crolla. He had worked with O.K. Allen was the governor at the time. I'm the guy's name I'm missing, but anyway, he was working with known mafia and political types getting heroin and cocaine from Honduras, and that worked through the State Department. So the State Department and the mafia were actually bringing in heroin together into New Orleans, and this is all before Barry Seal and Iran-Contra and all that. I'm talking. They were doing this in the 30s, like before the CIA even existed. So that baton just gets passed from one generation to the next, you know?
Yeah, that's,
and Bobby,
I mean,
he comes along and just shats on all of it, right?
Yeah, because you even get that into the 30s with Claire Chennault and the Flying Tigers and Burma that are via the Japanese, and even the Japanese were trading heroin or opium at the time, with the Chinese, and these things transcend that nation states and things like that. And it really is globalism. But originally,
the French connection was heroin with Lucky Luciano too.
Oh yeah,
prior
yeah.
to that,
yeah.
getting it from KTM, right? They were supplying them with, as long as you had some sort of anti-communist faction as your supplier, The Federal Bureau of Narcotics and all, they would look the other way.
Yeah.
And people like Pepe Escobar realized that Pablo Escobar. Pepe Escobar is not dealing heroin.
He's a journalist.
Pablo Escobar knew that a long time ago.
originally, going back through, because we mentioned Grant Cooper, the lawyer, is that he had an indictment hanging over his head during the trial, and he got off he only paid a fine or something. And so even that is grounds for a mistrial, because your lawyer is facing federal indictment on criminal charges.
Well, it's funny. It's like he did get convicted in 69,
yeah.
like months after, or a really short time period before the trial concludes. But so a lot of it fell on the co-counsel, and that was Russell Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy who he represented a lot of mafia clients and even wrote a personal glowing letter for Mickey Cohen, which actually later on when he tried to run for mayor of Los Angeles, this came to light and ruined his chances. And Mickey Cohen actually ran a gambling operation out of the Ambassador Hotel where Robert was shot.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
But the best part of this story is that Parson had once been investigated by the chief counsel of the Senate Racket Committee, which was Robert Kennedy.
Oh.
Robert Kennedy was investigating Sirhan Sirhan's lawyer.
Small world, right?
For his mafia ties.
Mm-hmm. Small world.
His other lawyer got convicted of mafia ties with Roselli. So isn't that something?
So now... So we have that information. So
I want to get into Sirhan's employment too, because this is all one big happy family. He there's a man named Frank Donaramas, but no one probably heard that knows who that is. But his sort of like street name was Henry Ramostella, and he was a Jersey mobster, kind of a New York, New Jersey mobster, and he befriended Sirhan because Sirhan used to work. He used to go to the Santa Ana racetrack all the time, and then he worked at the Del Mar racetrack, which is a hotbed of, who's who mobster gambler, including Hoover and the rest of them that would go there and watch the horses and things. But
yeah, that's the thing. That's when Hoover used to go and win all the time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
While denying the existence of organized crime.
Well, he'd have Tolson right there with him, right? Clyde Tolson would be anywhere Hoover went.
It's a romantic getaway.
Anywhere Hoover went, Tolson was right behind him. Let's just put it that way.
I think Lansky had that on film. No,
I've seen that, actually. Not film, I saw the pictures.
Oh, the humanity.
Yeah. And you know where they were? I'm not going to get into that. It was in Florida at a particular hotel owned by a particular family. We'll just say that. But this guy, Frank, hired Sirhan, and Sirhan was working at the Corona Breeding Farm in 1966, right? So just a couple years before he allegedly kills Robert Kennedy all by himself with his 8-shot revolver that shot 13 times in front of him and somehow hit him 3 times in the back. he was working for this Frank Donaramas, and who is a total mobster, right? And so it's like he's working at a horse breeding farm for the mob. He visits these racetracks where he's also in debt to the mob. And then his lawyers are all mobsters. Like, not just minor, like, oh, he represented so-and-so. We're talking about Johnny Roselli, Mickey Cohen, big names, you know. But that's all a coincidence, I'm sure. But what Carmine witnessed in jail, what Carmine and Hoffa were discussing, was a contract killing to kill RFK. I mean, that was witnessed before he was, a week before he was killed. And exactly at the same time that he's meeting with investigators looking in leads into his brother's death.
Yes, it's definitely of interest. Mm-hmm. So you have these mob connections, and yet nevertheless, the media is playing it up as just another crazy Arab Christian who's driven to murder, you know, to murder by what's going on in Palestine.
It wasn't even political. He's like, I don't eat Arab food and that junk. And he didn't care. And Robert's policies weren't so pro-Israel. Nixon certainly were. I mean, he gave us Operation Nickelgrass. I think they sent about 22,325 tons of weapons, tanks, et cetera, to Israel for Yom Kippur. But, the guy that actually shot RFK is named Thane Eugene Caesar, and he was a cop working for Ace Security all of a day. I mean, he'd worked for him many, many months ago, but he was a temporary employee.
This was a Lockheed subsidiary?
No, it's for the U.S. National Bank of San Diego subsidiary.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought he was a Lockheed contractor, but I might be mistaken.
I haven't seen anything with Thane and Lockheed. He may have done that after the shooting, but
okay.
At this time, it was this bank that John Alessio was a director for. And really, if you want to look into that bank, it's top to bottom. It's a who's who of the worst people we've ever heard of in the mob at the time period. Hoffa was working with them. But Alessio, very famous California mobster. And all these guys come out from the East Coast and stuff. But they had created this thing, Ace Security. And Ace Security was who was in charge of guarding Robert. And Thane is a last-minute replacement. He gets there. He's witnessed firing his gun, screwed up and even admitted that on a couple radio shows. And you could say, oh, well, maybe he was shooting back at Sirhan Sirhan. Like, maybe, right? And then maybe he accidentally shot Robert Kennedy. But they asked him, like, well, could your gun have gone off on accident? He goes, no, because the hammer wasn't cocked. I would have had to pull the trigger. I would have had to have done it on purpose. he wants the credit, but given the burn marks on Robert and the fact, and Thane admitted, I was holding his right arm. And if you look at the death photos of Robert Kennedy, you'll notice something in his hand. There's a necktie, and it's Thane's clip-on necktie that Robert pulled off of him as he was dying. Now, when Robert's last words is saying, "Is everybody okay?" and on to Chicago, like, he just got shot in the brain, so he doesn't. Whatever, it doesn't matter what he says, you know? But he's holding that tie in his hand. But that cop was right behind him, has a gun, was seen shooting the gun. There's burn marks on Robert's head, and the witnesses said he shot it Western style from the hip. Like, he just kind of pulled it out of the holster, kind of turned it, went dun-dun-dun, like that, right? He's not going to extend his arm out and shoot him in the head. He's trying to sort, just as the Sirhan's firing wildly and being tackled to the floor, he pulls out his gun and just goes like that, bang, bang, bang. And so that's why, and Robert gets hit all on the right side three times. And the death shot, of course, is, you know, behind his right ear. Almost just like John on the right side above his eye, right? So there's burn marks on there. And then they ask him what gun he had. And he lied and talked about this 35 caliber gun. But he also had a 22 caliber gun, which they asked about. He said, oh, no, I sold that one 3 months ago. But then they got the bill of sale, and he actually sold it in September of that year, 3 months after shooting Robert, not 3 months before. So then they went to the person who they had sold the gun to, who still had the receipt and everything, and they said, well, where's the gun? And he said, somebody stole it. Okay. But it was a .22 caliber, and it would have matched the ballistics. And, I mean, I don't know. Some people, they just want to make a mystery where there isn't one, you know? My brother deals with this with the Lost Colony. Or it's kind of like people who just want to believe in Bigfoot. It doesn't matter how much you debunk it. There will always be something. And these Kennedy, both Kennedy murders have been solved. Like, it's really clear that Thane Eugene Caesar shot Robert Kennedy. He's behind him with the gun. He's witnessed shooting it, and there's burn marks on his head. The guy works for Ace Security, which is run by the mob, and then he's living in the Philippines right now. He's like 89 years old, and you look at the rest of his life and all the lawyers and all the everything around the entire event is mafia-related, who Robert Kennedy was prosecuting. And that just gets completely ignored.
Well, one thing is the police never, I mean, after the shooting, of course, you'd think they'd get everyone who has a gun and kind of check them and look for things, if there's a drop gun or an extra gun there, or that was never done with Caesar, right? He was never questioned.
They asked, I mean, they questioned him. The cops didn't, but I mean, like journalists and things questioned him.
Yeah, I mean, you think the cop, the LAPD, who's they're solving, you're supposedly investigating this murder, and they have the hail of bullets, and just because there's a person in front of you with a gun saying, Kennedy, you son of a bitch, and firing doesn't necessarily mean that's the one who shoots them. Aren't they a little more sophisticated than that, or just an investigation that's intentionally, derailed?
Well, the police examiner did say that, as well as the coroner, I forget his name, I think it was
Noguchi?
Baxter or something. Yeah, I mean, you got it. They all agreed, like, how he was killed in the manner, and the LAPD, that they did go in and got bullets out of the door and took photographs of it, and that's really all that exists because the files got destroyed. But there is photographic evidence of the police examining the bullets that were in the side of the door and one in the center of the in the kitchen pantry thing. And so you can see all these extra bullets. And if you ask the police, they go, absolutely, there's no question. We knew that was those were bullet holes and bullets. And they don't disagree. But then you got to say, well, why didn't you grab this security guard and check out his gun? Well, because Thane just lied. He just said, oh, I sold it. I sold that gun, and all I had was this .35. So he just gives them a different gun, right? But that's not the gun he had that day. He had the other gun that he ended up selling in September. And I believe they actually, the one that was claimed to have been stolen, someone finally came forward, and they'd thrown it in the middle of a lake in Arkansas or something. They actually got the gun in like 2015 or 16, really? Something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, they pulled it out. Because they said, I threw it in this lake, and they looked where he said he had put it, and it was there. But it's useless now.
Yeah.
Unless they have some technology eventually that can somehow, who knows? You look at some of the stuff they do in archaeology, and it's pretty amazing, like what you can uncover with enough tech. But I don't think you need to really match the ballistics to the gun when you have, all this other evidence showing his people saw him do it. I mean,
now did his life change after the assassination? Did he all of a sudden come up with unexplained income and wealth? And has anybody been?
Yes,
he did.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even like exactly. He'd be like, hey man, lay low. Nah, he scurries off to the Philippines and living large. So
that's interesting because I think the investigation itself wasn't handled by Special Unit Senator and one of the guys who I think is on tape harassing witnesses, like Sandra Serrano or something, and then he ends up getting a security company, gets these huge fat contracts, and he becomes a multimillionaire.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole thing, like the whole California political scene was, like especially in Los Angeles with Hollywood, it's mafia top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that were the legit people that were investigating Robert's death all had things happen to them. This is a lot like John Kennedy's death. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of witnesses, and Roselli himself was murdered, but I'm talking about people that were pushing for a legit investigation into Robert Kennedy, were having their cars shot at, having guns pulled on them.
Yeah, Dorothy Kilgallen committing suicide.
Yeah, weird kind of suicide. What was the investigator whose wife was murdered? I can't remember his name. Like, it's been so long, like, since I looked at RFK, because to me, it's overkill. But there was, I can't remember the guy's name. His wife was murdered now. It'll come to me. But, you know, when your family's getting threatened or your car is being shot at, that'll make you shut up, you know. And that was happening to people who were just trying to figure it out. Now, Sirhan Sirhan doesn't wield that kind of power. I mean, he was in jail, right?
And Lee Harvey Oswald was dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, going back to the Kennedy thing, right?
You want to go to that. So, you know, that wasn't Sirhan Sirhan harassing witnesses and things like that. No way. But those are the kind of things that happen. It's like William Harper, for example, was had his car shot at, and that was the day before he was going to testify about the case, and he had two men follow him and shoot up his car. And I mean, that happened. I mean, that is part of the record. William Harper's car was shot at the day before he's testifying, and. Godfrey Isaac, that's what it was. Godfrey Isaac, his wife was killed. He was the DA. And then one of the main journalists, Theodore Chirac, he had all kinds of harassment. People pulled a gun on him. His assistant, Betty Dreyer, she got killed with a knife, I think, or stabbed a bunch of times. So they start saying, maybe I ought to back off from this. I mean, and this was just a journalist that was looking into it. His assistant gets knifed. They pull a gun on him. The DA's wife dies under mysterious circumstances. There's suicidings. And then Harper's car gets shot up. Who do you think is doing that? A Palestinian gang? No.
That's, none of this stuff is... I mean, this is the RFK assassination, and this is very similar to what was going on with the JFK aftermath of the JFK assassination. Was these, well, one thing, that the murder of witnesses and these things, starting with one, Lee Harvey Oswald, 2 days later, you know. But that gets us into what we're really
Rubenstein.
Rubenstein, a Brofman, lieutenant.
Yeah, and they go, oh, they didn't know each other, and there were absolutely no mob connections to Jack Ruby. Wow. Like, no one can say that. But that's what the Warren Commission comes up with. And I think it was one of Henry Crown's lawyers that was tasked with figuring that out. And, of course, that's the answer he came up with.
Yeah.
Duh. Mm-hmm.
And even Oswald has ties back to the New Orleans scene. But he's a... he is a complex figure in itself.
Caesar himself had been in trouble before he gets to become a cop for Ace Security. He had gotten in a lot of trouble down in Tijuana, and the fixer for it that cleaned him up was John Alessio himself. So he owed him. He owed Alessio big time already.
So you had a mob connected security guard standing behind Robert F. Kennedy, where the shot. Where the mortal wound occurred, where the shot occurred, that you got from behind the right ear, and with the very mob that has, of course, has it out for Robert Kennedy, and apparently had negotiated or had a contract put out on him,
and he had been okay. This guy had gotten out of trouble because John Alessio got him out, and it's. The bank that Alessio is the director of is the one that creates and hires a security that Thane is working for, and he gets hired that day, like on June 4th, right? So that night, the same day, really, because he really was killed on the 4th. It was just a little bit after midnight, so we'd say June 5th. But you know, he goes in there. So the cop that shot him is working for a security company that run by a bank by John Alessio, and the same mobster also got thing out of trouble earlier when he got arrested in Tijuana several times, by the way. So that's not a coincidence.
And Caesar, what ethnicity is he? Is he Mexican? Is he Cuban? Or
I don't know. Payne Eugene Caesar. Out of his pictures, he just looks Italian, but maybe with the name Caesar, he could be Italian or he could be.
Yeah. But he moves to the Philippines?
Yeah.
Okay. A security guard. Okay.
Yeah, right? And like a part time security guard, too.
Yeah, interesting.
And they had other. The mobsters that had hired Sirhan for the farm and things, Frank, mm-hmm. they couldn't find these guys for like 10, 11 months to testify. They couldn't find them. They couldn't find anybody that was associated with Sirhan. They all got out of town. They found them eventually, but it took a long time.
Now, so we have all that. And of course, the evidence all indicates that it was a wider, it was a conspiracy, a much wider conspiracy involving, shall we say, the usual suspects, I guess, in how we look at these things.
Plus the guys that Kennedy was prosecuting.
Yeah.
You know, they had the motive.
But the killing of Robert Kennedy in 1968 obviously traces back to the murder of his brother, 4.5 years earlier in November 1963 in Dallas. And, the suspects involved in that are, the mafia, CIA, the military industrial complex, all these sort of vague names and associations and organizations.
Well, there's a lot of overlap between all those organizations.
Yeah.
Because the CIA was hiring mafia all the time.
Yeah, they're contracting with them. And, obviously we have that example. It gets real murky and convoluted because this involves Cuba, Mongoose, which actually involves Robert Kennedy in these things. The Cold War intrigues and sort of this very murky involvement. No one really has their hands clean in this thing. It's geopolitics. So everyone.
Well, the mafia, they found a very easy alliance between the mob and the CIA and those kind of guys, because when Castro came to power and Batista was out, the mob lost about $1 billion a year mm-hmm. from all the casinos that were shut down in Cuba. And the replacement was Las Vegas, mm-hmm. right? But you got to legalize gambling, but only in one little place so you can monopolize at the same time. So all that casino revenue, which is very important because that's how you launder money for a lot of other illegal businesses mm-hmm. from the prostitution, narcotics, and skimming from the unions and all that. You'd be like, oh, gambling, that's how I got it, or whatever. So
banks and casinos.
they wanted Castro out just as bad as the CIA because they lost a lot of revenue. But there were certain guys like Traficante acting as triple agents. Because that's the great thing about career criminals is they'll stab each other in the back too. But mm-hmm. So that's why you'll see contracts by the CIA contacting people like Sam Giancana and trying to get them to assassinate Fidel. And this allowed them at the same time to be protected. And of course, the FBI was no problem. Hoover denied organized crime even existed, because Costello and Lansky had the dirt on him and his G-men. I think he's on tape saying that. The mafia, conspiracy, just poo-pooing the whole thing. There's no such thing as conspiracy. What mafia? Well, Robert Kennedy comes along and starts prosecuting them. And they find out, the world finds out, the mafia is absolutely real. And, now everyone sees, people know the mob is real, but they believe their version of what the mafia is sort of this Hollywood or Sopranos thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like a street gang or something. They don't understand the true depth and power of organized crime.
Yeah, it ties
the government.
It's a street crew, and you've watched shows like The Sopranos. It's always you have the criminal world, and then there's the government going after them. And they do they do suggest some collusion, which but that's more at a lower level. It's more, you know,
like, oh, there's this one crooked cop they bribed or something like that, right?
As opposed to being institutionalized in terms of
it went all the way up to Nixon. Like I said, he's pardoning serial killers. He commuted Jimmy Hoffa. I mean, Nixon was the syndicate president. That was his nickname off the books or whatever. He was the syndicate president.
Mm-hmm.
They, I mean, Mickey Cohen donated tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars to Nixon. If you combine his, you know, attempt at becoming governor and two attempts to become president. And so did Alessio. So did all the prominent mobsters are cashing in on Nixon.
Yeah, and then because then there's always the meta mobsters like the Harrimans and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Rothmans, who have become sort of financiers and elite, and so it's they all work together and they all kind of organize these things. That the importance of banking and finance and even and the importance of narcotics trafficking and supporting the global economy and liquidity of the banks and creating the whole like underworld or black budget economy that really... And
that's how it is now. Who do you think's moving the heroin from Afghanistan into our streets? Yeah. I mean, it's not like the CIA pays CIA agents to distribute heroin. Like, they always have plausible deniability. And that stuff's coming right into Newark Airport right now, right?
Yeah.
And it's run by the mob. And I want to go to New York in the future, so I ain't saying any names, but they are doing it.
Yeah, and it is sanctioned, and that's all. The whole part of the drug war is to maintain a cartel, and there are some groups that gain the favor for a while. And
I mean, we gave guns to Mexican cartels. We armed them in recent times, not just Fast and Furious either.
That was a mistake.
Oh yeah. We had no means of tracing the guns once they crossed the border either. So
the Zetas,
how is it you're going to get the guns to trace then you can't taste?
Yeah, you know, it's all part. You know, again, this is the guns are sent in there to destabilize, to stir things up a little bit, to keep the companies, these countries poor and exploitable, and that's sort of the business model. It's a neoliberal business model. We've talked about like what's going on in Africa before and these things and the fomenting of these civil wars.
I finished the film on that, by the way. I just said What's Keeping Africa Down. Not a very clever title, but it gets into all that. The whole humanitarian farce, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they go in and purposely destroy agriculture and ruin agency to create dependency states.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to the old Banana Republic model that they did on Central America and the Caribbean, but there's just slightly a few more layers added to it, because now that we've got these global banking institutions that can engage in predatory lending and just use that as a method of seizing assets, right?
Yeah.
That happens in Africa all day, every day. Not all of Africa, but a lot of places in Africa are dealing with that. All-time favorite level of corruption is Nigeria, though. And people can look this up right now. The snake ate it. I mean, I think it was last March or February. It was something like $100,000 went missing, and the clerk's excuse was a snake came in and ate the bags of money. And then the next month, it was monkeys. So you can Google that. Monkeys and snakes steal money, Nigeria. Just put that in. This is real. And I was reporting these stories in my Africa film, and somebody watched that. And I wanted to get the most recent stuff, so I finished that film in March. So those events have happened in February, March. But I guarantee you, if you look into it, there's that stuff is every month. There's stuff, ridiculous things like that. But near the end of the film, I talked about the snake ate it, the monkey stole it, just going over the level of domestic corruption in Africa, because you can't blame everything on the outside. A lot of it's just bad African politics, right? But after seeing the snake and monkey stole the money, somebody left I love the internet sometimes, they left the most brilliant comment. They said, oh, I didn't know Donald Rumsfeld went to work in Nigeria. It's missing. I guess the snake ate it.
Well, and that corruption, and like foreign aid and these things, NGOs, This relates to the RFK assassination, because the involvement of, at least the alleged involvement of the Savak, and this character Khyber Khan, and apparently he was involved in foreign aid going to Iran during the era of the Shah in the late 60s. And
yeah, well, the Israeli secret police are the ones training the Savak.
Yeah, the Savak. Yeah, and they're the ones that pretty much foment the revolution 10 years later. Because of the Savaks, you know, they're the ones stirring up trouble and really alienating their Iranian population. And of course, at the time, they're being controlled by MI6, CIA, and Mossad. But the foreign aid, a lot of it is being filtered back into, like, the Chase Manhattan Bank and David Rockefeller's pocket. And it's just a big scam.
It undermines industry. Like, sometimes aid isn't money. Sometimes, like, there's the food programs, and UN will give you calorie bars and things like that, mm-hmm. right? And it's very hard to oppose that because you sound like a cold-hearted libertarian or something.
Yeah.
I explain it like this. Like, let's say you're selling shoes or trying to. And I just set up next to you and give away shoes. What happens to your business?
Yeah.
You go out of business, right? Well, what happens if people are giving away food and you're trying to actually grow crops and sell them, and here I come, free bags of rice or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to stay in the agricultural industry because you can't make a profit. So they have a shortage of farmers, which causes a shortage of food, which makes them more dependent on aid. And it's a vicious cycle, right? They have to have the aid because they don't have enough farmers. But because of the aid is why they don't have farmers, because they can't make profits.
Yeah, and the corn or the rice that's being imported is heavily subsidized by the government. So other people are paying for it. Right,
multiple governments in this case. Yeah,
yeah. So it's not,
or it'll be some commodity company like Glencore or something, which is then, because they do that kind of quote unquote altruistic act, then they get subsidies too.
Yeah.
So that it's an excuse to subsidize extremely wealthy corporations already, who give these token, you know, bits of aid to Haiti or to Mali or Kenya or whatever. But actually, you're just removing agency and creating dependency states.
Yeah, this is what NAFTA did to Mexico. They call it free trade, and it really isn't free trade.
Yeah.
And really, in the final analysis, you can't have free trade when you have malevolent corporations that are heavily subsidized, that are controlled by psychopaths.
They're subsidized, and they have volume discount purchasing. Mm-hmm. So it's like the Walmartization of Mexico.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And again, they have all types of forms of subsidies and benefits, and
what happens there with Mexico, for example, there's a chapter about this in my, I just finished the second edition of Separation of Business and State.
Mm-hmm.
So this was in the first one as well. But if you're going to undermine an industry like agriculture, and you have an agrarian society, or at least large sections of Mexico were like that, and here comes Walmart, McDonald's, or whatever, who have their super, it's like, okay, you can have super cheap goods because they're subsidized by the United States. Walmart's not subsidized, but all the places they're buying their food from are.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get the volume discount. So they get in, and you're not allowed to tariff it because supposedly free trade. So they come in and flood the market and put the other people out of business, including the farmers. So, and where do they go? The fruit pickers, quote unquote.
Well, they
across
head
the border into the United States, which makes exploited labor and undermines wages and so on and so on. So it's just bad all around.
But the obvious solution is to build a big wall.
Yeah. The solution is to cut the subsidies protective tariffs.
The problem is identifying the point of intervention and coercion. It's hard to unravel these things, at least in the standpoint of like retail politics and public discourse. People don't want to get into the details of these things. How these societies?
Well, any trade agreement that's written up in secret, just say no.
Yeah, or it's 500 pages, you know, 2,000 pages. You know.
Yeah, and it's all written in legalese and all. Yeah, don't do that.
You know, and also just in an era, just broadly speaking, macroeconomically speaking, is this with currency manipulation, and the whole world is based on currency manipulation. That's what the petrodollar is all about. And the idea is when you have currencies overvalued and currencies can be devalued, it's hard to maintain balance of trade because these things are manipulated politically, right? And oligarchs.
Well, there is currency manipulation, but the petrodollar thing to me is a distraction from Israel. because the U.S. will complain all the time about how China is buying too many dollars,
yeah,
manipulating the currency, and yet they're trying to sell more dollars by increasing demand by forcing people to buy oil on it. One, they're not forced to. Like, Japan and India got off the petrodollar a long time ago and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's for convenience. Nobody wants to convert things, you know, through 12 different currencies a day. If you get Korean dollars, you know, because I buy your oil with Korean dollars, mm-hmm. where are you supposed to spend those other than Korea?
Yeah.
Right? Maybe. But a dollar you can spend where. I get a little triggered on that topic because there's this sort of huge leftist wave that blames the Iraq war on oil or petrodollars, which is related to oil. And no, we went to war for Israel. The Office of Special Plans specifically lied, and they were all Israeli partisans. And Israel got 77% of its oil export or imports from the Kurdish-controlled region in Iraq. The U.S. didn't get jack. Our oil imports from Iraq after the war and before the war are exactly the same. And Saddam was not going to switch to the euro, and even because we already invaded in 91 and the euro didn't even exist, neither did the EU. That, and we already had the oil for food program, so we already owned the oil. So we didn't go to Iraq for oil. We went there for Israel. And you can trace back the lies about anthrax, the lies about mobile weapons labs, which was supposedly making the anthrax, chemical weapons under the palaces, aluminum tubes, yada, 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 and the Jir forgeries, et cetera. And they all go back to Israeli partisans who had written this out in strategy planning papers about Iraq and Libya and Syria. And we have just done that verbatim. Like, we went in Iraq, destabilized it, got control of the oil, which went to Israel. They killed Gaddafi, sodomized him with a knife, and put al-Qaeda in charge. And they tried to do it in Syria, and they've lost. Because Russia intervened, and well, a lot of things happened, but Syria right now, I'm going to tell people, after the 14th of June, there will be an attack on Daraa, and that whole southern pocket of al-Qaeda and ISIS is going to get wiped out. And there'll just be that little pocket up in Idlib. That war is pretty much over, and Assad is there to stay. So, but they certainly tried, and they turned that place upside down since 2011. I mean, 7 years of fighting, but...
But a lot of refugees, a lot of people dead, a lot of old architecture destroyed.
They wrecked Europe with it because even though most of these refugees aren't Syrian, maybe half, a million and a half or something, but it served as cover for refugees from everywhere else because you're bleeding heart people like, oh, the poor Syrian refugees. And I agree, like for people from Syria, but they're from Tunisia, they're from Pakistan, they're from all over the world flooding into Europe and sucking off the tit of government.
Yeah, why are
I say, hey, if you don't want ants, don't pour sugar on the floor. Cannot, as I think Rothbard or Friedman or one of them said something like, you can't have open borders and social programs at the same time.
Yeah, another form of intervention then. That's another of these things where, yeah, the welfare state will, one of the things that made America able to absorb so many immigrants quite successfully, I'd say, in the early part of the 20th century was the absence, of a welfare state.
Yes. You are free to come over here and work.
Yeah.
And, not just live off the tit of government.
Yeah, and just the whole country was so much less decentralized at the time. It was ethnic-based, and at least particularly in the North, and these things could function. There was sort of a proper balance there. And the United States itself, really only works successfully as a decentralized country as it has become more centralized in the 20th century. It's become a more destructive force throughout the world. I think there's a connection there. But back to Robert F. Kennedy, because you mentioned the...
I blame Lincoln for all that. That's yes, when it started.
The corporate...
He's the original neocon, and that's where the railroad companies were the first kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, they were like replacing the East India Tea Company as far as its power and influence, right? And that's where we switched from a market economy to mercantilism with the railroads. And there's a great series, I think it was on AMC, is that what it's called? It was called Hell on Wheels. And Thomas Durant, who worked for the Union Pacific Railroad, there's this Irish actor, his name, but he does a brilliant job of it. They're talking about, there's a scene in there, and they're saying, I'm getting $1,600 per mile for this railroad, and why are you making it straight? I don't want it going like this. I want it going like this.
And yeah.
Because like, it's government subsidized.
Yeah, they'd build over like on frozen land, and of course it'd thaw out, and they'd have to rebuild it again. And of course, the senator's...
He's got another line, and yeah. This guy's like, the government comes down. They're in Wisconsin or something. And they just send over, Grant sends over somebody to just be the judge, the governor, and the policeman or whatever. And they're like, well, we're gonna have to get this land or whatever. And he goes, well, I have land to sell. And he says, oh, well, we're talking about issuing taxes. He goes, do you mean to tax me to get the money to buy my own land? Why don't you just steal it? But like all this stuff actually happened, but they're playing it out hell on wheels. If you pay attention to certain scenes and you're a dork like me on the Civil War and stuff and the Indian Wars and so on, you'll know exactly what they're referencing. And it's really good.
That's right. Yeah. You brought the government in there. That's when they could get brutal with everybody, not have to negotiate. And that's, I think was James J. Hill, who built the Great Northern Railroad, who didn't have to kill anybody, at least reportedly, to build this railroad. It was done at a profit. And it was rational.
All of our railroads, canals, and roads before 1865 were built by venture capitalists without a single tax dollar.
Yeah, yeah. It was eternal improvements, as the Whigs called it, and that's what Lincoln picked up. And, you know, and a lot of these things, the idea of, of using tax dollars to build these things, and it was always political, because obviously where you put the railroads was going to shape who's going to get rich and who didn't get rich. I think it was it Lincoln himself, right before signing the Transcontinental Railroad Bill, bought land out west where there's going to be the meetup point for the Pacific.
So did Sherman.
Yeah. And so they all were railroad guys. Made money.
He was a railroad lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a psychopathic killer at the same time. So, but back to we were talking about RFK, and you Chris,
Carmine Galante was considered a psychopath in jail. These mob guys, man, I don't think people like, there's sort of this weird thing like, ooh, the mafia is kind of cool or something. It's not cool. I mean, these are psychopathic killers that beat and torture and exploit people. I mean, they're terrible people. There's nothing cool or clever about it. It's not like they're at a big risk either, because they're working with the government, not against them. So.
Yeah, that's another thing. They're not being hounded by the feds or anything. They're actually working with them. You brought up the Zionist Israeli angle here to this stuff. When we talked about the petrodollar, that sort of being a cover for this, you know, all the Iraq wars and Middle East.
I mean, the petrodollar is real, and there is a, that's why Saudi Arabia buys so many weapons with recycled petrodollars. Yeah. You know, because they sell oil all over the world and they receive dollars, and they use those dollars to buy arms, mm-hmm. right? But it's overblown stuff to say, well, that's why we went to Iraq. And especially to then say, oh, yeah, same thing Libya, same thing Syria. Nah, that ain't what connects them. It's Israel.
Yeah, it's also a big resource grab, too, because of Gaddafi's gold and these things. We've got that in WikiLeaks with Hillary Clinton talking about that. But
actually, I can debunk that, too.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. That's fine. I just read about that. But anyway, the getting back to RFK, because, okay, we have all this going on, and... To get to the answer of why RFK was shot, we went through the kind of
and why they used a Palestinian patsy.
Yeah, we have to go back to JFK, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so you want to kind of unravel that. We have RFK being killed in 68, but I think the suspicion is that he was taken out in 68 because they figured he might reopen the investigation of his brother's murder if he became president. And he would have a lot of the considerable power of all the office of the presidency holds to do that. So he had to be denied the White House.
And even if he had just become president and went after the mob like he had been doing, that was a big enough threat anyway. But when he won the California primary, because you got to realize back then, it wasn't like California was always Republican or always Democrat or whatever. I mean, it could now it's just Democrat, right? Yeah. But it was kind of, Nixon got it, Reagan got it, it was possible. So when he won that, and that's the largest state, the writing was on the wall. I mean, he's a Kennedy. He was good looking. He had charm. He was going to win. He was going to be president, most likely. you know.
Nixon would lose to another Kennedy.
Oh, he would lose his mind, you know, and he barely lost to John, you know, after all the cheating. Both of them cheated, but...
hey, the Democrats cheated fair and square better, so they won it.
They were, well, they all cheat, yeah, and they all did. Cheat, so. Kennedy's father helped make a deal with the mob.
That's what I always say.
They must feel really betrayed because they get in there and then Bobby and Jack start prosecuting them. Of course, Bobby was never made privy to any of these backroom deals with the mob, you know. He actually hated him because they saw how they manipulated his father and ran him around in circles. And so he was on a path for revenge and then got himself and his brother killed. But the mob is not the Italian mafioso that you see on Hollywood. I mean, there are some like that, but that wasn't the problem for the Kennedys.
Is it the Quakers?
It was a different group. It wasn't the Quakers. It wasn't the Eskimo.
Well, that's getting this whole. You hit names like Lansky and Brofman, you know, right? And, you know, mm-hmm. Mo Dallas and these guys, and you get in the whole thing of Zionism, how this is a huge, vast global criminal enterprise, you know, that exerts so
and
much
just
power.
Like the CIA, you know, that other intelligence agencies also contract out to organized crime. I mean, yes. That's how we are with ISIS right now, right? Or Aral al-Sham for many years, or Jandala. A lot of these mercenary groups that you'll see in Syria or Iran or Yemen or Boko Haram, etc., they're not independent little guerrilla organizations or something. They're getting tow missiles and money and things like that from states. Mm-hmm. And it's multinational. Syria is a great example because you'll see Turkey, the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE all funneling in weapons, cash, and support to terrorist groups through different mediums, but they're all doing it. So it's not like they're just tied to the CIA or something.
Yeah, was it Victor Ostrovsky? He says that Carlos the Jackal was a Mossad asset, if he's to be believed.
Yeah, I believe it.
Makes sense if you think about it, right?
I believe that, yeah. Absolutely.
Because the job of the Mossad is to keep Jews terrified as well. Right? I mean...
Yeah, it's not like... I don't want people to think there's some sort of Jewish teleology to become a mafia or, you know, a criminal banker or something like that. But there is a group that has an ideology of Zionism, which is tied to religion and other things, that sees itself as this sort of ethnic unit and does things for the interests of their clique. And you'll see that with the Italian mob too, and Irish gangs and stuff. There is an ethnic component to it because they make it like that. Mm-hmm. We didn't do that. They did. It's just true. There are black street gangs, for example. That doesn't mean the blacks are street gangs. It means the street gangs are black. You know, I don't want people to put the cart before the horse, which unfortunately happens too much.
Well,
prosecuting these Jewish mobsters are Jewish too.
People say things like the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Didn't mean that
they
every
don't say military. They just say Japanese. Yeah,
exactly. The Germans invaded Poland. So we speak in these terms because just for purposes of simplicity, we have to generalize at some point in language.
Right. And there is definitely a Jewish mafia.
Yeah, there is a Jewish mafia. And they identify as Jews, and they organize as such. And so therefore, to talk about them, in order to know your enemy, at least know that you're
And they
your
have
subject.
An affinity with Israel.
Yes.
And you can see these guys, Siegel and them, are taking profits and helping to prop up settlements and land grabs and annexation with Israel. I mean, Lansky went to live over there. He retired to Israel. So it is something that they believe, and it is part of their motivation, and it's part of their support. And that's kind of the reason that Jewish and Italian mafias grew so big post-World War II is the U.S. aligned itself with organized crime in Italy because that was a power rival to Mussolini. So as Mussolini was fascist, he had actually butted out the former assholes, which was the organized crime and the Sicilians and so on. And so you'll see things like liaisons between the United States and very prominent mafia figures. Doug Valentine's gone all over this in Strength of the Pack. And very well-known figures. And so they'll have state sponsorship back in the United States. Like Lucky Luciano and a lot of these guys that were very successful in New York still had ties to Sicily or some part of Italy that where they are getting sponsorship. Because these guys were governors, mayors. They were put in very prominent positions of power after World War II because they had fought against Mussolini. You see the same thing in Japan. A lot of the Yakuza groups, because they're so anti-Chinese and everything, and that became, you know, we had the Korean War and threats with China, etc., that they were allowed to take very prominent positions within the Reconstruction government in Japan because the U.S. wanted those right-wing lunatics, emperor worshippers, etc., because they would definitely go break up strikes and unions and stuff or any kind of leftist movement, which, you know, because of the fear of communism, they didn't even want anything. So they would have their strike busters and stuff, and the ones who were willing to do that were these right-wing Japanese Yakuza mafia types. And so that's why you start seeing alliances between government and criminal organizations, so the criminals can do the dirty work and there's plausible deniability. And the Israelis absolutely work with the American mafia. They have a Jewish mob in many countries.
And there was a Jewish mafia which maintained this very important flow of arms to Israel in right after World War II, with Mo Dalitz, Meyer Lansky, the pipeline that they maintained.
Well, Permadex was part of that.
And it gets, yeah, that's what I was getting. It gets the Permadex, because Permadex factors into both assassinations. So, I guess in tribute to Michael Collins Piper, talk about the case regarding the Israeli element to the
one that brought in Theodore Rosenbaum and yeah. I mean Piper does a little chalkboard video going over it, and if you dig into that you'll know exactly why JFK was killed and who did it. I mean Piper was onto it, and I'm in the middle of making a movie about it, so that's even RFK I'm kind of saying, oh, I don't know, or I can't remember, but it's really, I just don't want to say because I'm trying to sell a film. Okay. I don't want to, or it's like, oh, that'll take an hour to explain, so I'll just skip it or something. But in a show that's limited time like this, I'm trying to package it to say, look, we have a guy witness firing his gun who's right behind Senator Kennedy, who lied about when he sold it. He works for a security company run by a bank from John Alessio, who also got him out of trouble, and then all the lawyers and mafia. I think that's enough information to be like, okay, the mafia killed him. If you want to get into why, it's not just because he was prosecuting himself. If you want to get into why specifically, it does tie into geopolitics, and of course it goes back to Israel. But that takes some explaining, and not like an hour show. Okay. But yeah, it definitely does. And I know I clearly can see the direction you're going, tying it into John and getting that back with that. Because if you want to get into like James Jesus Angleton and the Dulles brothers, who are all hardcore Zionists, I mean, Angleton's got a forest named after him in Israel and plaques and so on. They were essentially Israeli agents working in the United States government anyway. I mean, look at the oldest operations with Operation Ajax and the attempted Operation Susanna and stuff. The oldest things, first things the CIA ever did were all on behalf of Israel. And the counterintelligence czar was Angleton, a Jewish partisan that had a deep affinity with Israel. Mm-hmm. And there's books about Angleton. And if you read any of them, the Ghost is a great one. It'll become real clear real fast.
And because the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy occurred almost a year right after the Liberty incident, right?
Yep, it was actually he was killed on the anniversary of the Six-Day War.
Yeah,
by a Palestinian. Ain't that something?
So coincidence, I guess.
Wait till after midnight so it can be on the anniversary.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Liberty, I'm sure everyone knows the Liberty, but if they don't, you know, that Palestinian medic, that 21-year-old medic that got shot and killed by Israeli snipers, I sarcastically tweeted out that, she's clearly wearing a uniform that says medic and is helping somebody else who had been shot. That part of the story gets left out, but maybe they thought she was an Egyptian ship.
And they what? Three waves of attacks. They shot her three separate times.
You know what? Yeah, one of the pilots later refused to bomb Gaza, and they reprimanded him for it. Is Yousef something? I had to look that up. For real, I don't know that one. But the Liberty stuff is stuff I've talked about so many times. I wish I just had a button to push to go.
You know, well, I mean, Lyndon Johnson stopping it. You know, I don't care if that damn ship sinks. We're not going to embarrass an ally. Of course,
Lyndon Johnson's aunt was one of the founders of the Zionist American Council, which Kennedy was trying to register as a foreign agent, which they call AIPAC today. And he was the last person to do it. And Robert Kennedy wrote him letters, and because he was the head of the DOJ under John's presidency. And they had to get rid of them. I mean, they were inspecting nukes at Dimona. They supported the Palestinian right of return. And we're talking numbers, 100,000 they wanted back in Israel, which the Israelis, they, you know, being ardent racists that want an ethnic demographic majority. They didn't want Palestinians to live, you know, in their own homes. So they wanted them out. But the Kennedys were supporting right of return, supporting, you know, looking into the nuclear weapons. And Ben-Gurion resigned over it. It was that important, you know, trying to stall for time. They had to get rid of John.
And
had to.
Yeah, the connection, of course, to the assassination, of course, was, exposed by Garrison's investigation. I guess he was originally going after David Ferry, but David Ferry conveniently died, and then he focused on Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw worked for Permadex, which traces back to Tibor Rosenbaum and this Credit Bank International in Switzerland, which traces back to the Brofmans, because they launder money for the Brofmans, and we were talking
earlier. Well, it also traces into Charlie Winters and all these arms smugglers that were bringing in, and even the Numex scandal. I mean, that ties all straight into that, Rosenbaum and the rest of them.
Which Grant Smith covers. Working
with Zalman Shapiro and the rest of them. Yeah, Grant Smith got, well, he doesn't get into the Kennedy stuff, although I have talked to him personally, and he knows, he's red-pilled, but those books are strictly on the diversion of nuclear material and focused on, like, Raphael Adenton and, you know, Zalman Shapiro and the people directly involved.
Yeah, this nuclear program is very interesting because you have this sort of this huge weapons, you know, this espionage operation being carried out, and the government just seems helpless to stop it or really investigate it rigorously, but it's out there. The information is there. But in regards to the Kennedy assassination, JFK's killing, you've talked about, some of you talked about this, is the you know, the movie JFK by Oliver Stone, which names this sort of this vague military industrial complex as the perpetrator.
Blame it all on gay Nazis.
Gay Nazis. But
they made them all homosexual. And
the producer for that film was... The funny thing is, who's the producer?
They kind of blamed the CIA in that, like, oh, he didn't give us air support for Bay of Pigs, so we're mad, we're going to kill him. Then he fires Cord Meyer and he fired Dulles, but... that's kind of the classic JFK conspiracy theory, kosher and everything. But not only did they not talk about the mafia, the only line they give about the mafia is him saying, you think the mafia could cover up blah, 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 and totally dismissing any mob connection. And the whole thing is written, or was the executive producer was Arnon Milchan.
Yeah.
Who is Israel's largest arms dealer. Legal and illegal.
And by arms deal, you mean he's engaged in espionage against the United States, people in the United States, by engaging in illegal arms shipments. Didn't he do that, like the triggers or something? And he got a medal for it?
Yeah, the Krytron triggers, actually, they smuggled to this company called Heli Trading Company. And on the other side was a little dude named Benjamin Netanyahu.
A furniture salesman, right?
Uh-huh. Like star furniture in with Lorex. What's his name? Yellow Lorex in Louisiana.
That's right, yeah.
That was a front for a heroin smuggling operation, if anybody doesn't know. But they he was smuggling Krytron triggers, which are used in nuclear weapons. And Benjamin Netanyahu and Arnon Milchan are involved in this, and that came out because of a lawsuit by Airmap. But it's hard to get it's really hard to disseminate this information because, I mean, we're still at a point where you got to tell Americans that the West Bank is under occupation and that they build Jewish-only cities called settlements. where only Jews are allowed to live.
Ryan, I'm constantly reminded that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and they're our allies.
Last time I checked, everybody around them has a democracy except for Saudi Arabia and Jordan.
Oh, details.
Yeah. Lebanon, what? They have a parliament? What?
But yeah,
Israel is a theocracy. It's a fascist theocracy is what it is. More like, so, we let some Arabs in the Knesset. I'm like, okay.
I know, yeah. Token Arabs
in the Knesset. How very progressive of you.
It's nice of you. And I guess it's begun more so as the settlers have come to Israel. Their politics has become more radical, especially with Likud. And, of course, Likud stems from... Doesn't Likud like ultimately come like the Stern gang?
It goes back to Irgun. Irgun,
yeah. Yeah, and aren't they the ones that threatened to kill Harry Truman?
Well, have you seen the film I did on the SS Patria?
Yeah,
I mean, they were killing other Jews so that they couldn't leave Palestine. And the guys from the Jewish Agency, which becomes the first government of Israel, that are involved in Haganah, Stern, Irgun, that are chopping off heads, throwing grenades through windows, blowing up trains, blowing up boats, blowing up hotels, blew up an embassy. Total terrorists, right? The first hijacked airliners, all that, are all Jewish terrorists. These people are people like Ben-Gurion, you know, people like Menachem Begin, people that go on to become prime ministers of Israel were all in these terrorist gangs in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a few bad apples. It's a few good apples, and the rest are rotten to the core.
Well, how else do you create a state, Ryan?
Well, states are always through terrorism. The difference is acknowledge it. No, the U.S. doesn't deny they genocided Indians or anything. But Israel still tries to act like they're innocent and didn't do. They do nothing wrong. You know?
Well, you have to go see the movie Exodus to set your story straight about.
Oh, my gosh. That was one of the quotes.
Paul Newman and Kirk Douglas.
Yeah, I think I'll, if I ever need to puke.
now you're kind of alluding to this, but you have a documentary about Israeli, the first terrorist state, right? Or
it's the called The Jewish State in scare quotes, because mm-hmm. I don't consider it a Jewish state, but that's what they call themselves. It's called The Jewish State: How Terrorists Form a Nation, and it's only like $4 because I kind of want everyone to see it. But I made it with another guy, and I got to pay him too. Mm-hmm. So, but it's on Vimeo on demand, and it's a short little thing. And once we reach a certain benchmark, we're going to make part two, because I didn't even get into Levon or Liberty or any of that. I'm still in the 30s, because people like, even if they start the story at 48, I go no. What? Let's go all the way. You don't have to go to World War I or anything, but I wanted to go over all these terrorist attacks that happened before Israel was Israel. Like, while it was still Palestine, the way they became Israel was through constant terrorist attacks, killing British sailors, killing Palestinians, killing non-Zionist Jews. Things like Deir Yassin, where they just murdered 250 people and kept a few of them alive to put in cages to parade around Jerusalem as trophies. Like, it was utterly disgusting. And a lot of prominent Jews, like I mentioned, Albert Einstein, were writing about and being disgusted by this. But it just fell on deaf ears, I suppose, because they created the state anyway, and these terrorists end up electing each other, and it's never stopped. Sharon was a terrorist. The only prime minister that was ever actually born in Israel was Netanyahu. All the rest of them migrated there from Poland or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And Netanyahu really went to school in Pennsylvania, and he's American. You know? But yeah, it's a terrorist state. So it's called The Jewish State: How Terrorists Formed a Nation. And so that's up on Vimeo on demand. And there's a trailer for it on YouTube. It starts off with the Patria bombing, because I want that to be a household thing like the Liberty, because 55 British sailors were murdered and over 200 Jews were killed. And I feel like it's kind of an unknown incident. And it just, that's just one, you know, and I'm walking from that attack up to the Liberty. And I think a lot of people's jaws hit the floor and go, oh my gosh, how many boats did they blow up? And how many, like, cause it's just continuous. And I say, how come you never heard of this? If you haven't, which is, I think, the majority of people, even people who are interested in the Israel-Palestine issue will learn stuff from this film. Because they're like, whoa, I didn't know that happened. Oh, yep. Yeah, that's what went down. And so I think a timeline for the beginning of how that state was made is desperately needed. So I went in and did that. But really, that if we once we do part two, it's going to lead right up to the Kennedys, because they're the ones that tried to put a stop to all of it. And both of them end up dead.
And policy vis-a-vis Israel changes right after as well.
Exactly. Like, the people were like, oh, it's Vietnam, or oh, it's Cuba, or because Bay of Pigs, like I was saying, the Oliver Stone thing. I was like, did we reinvade Cuba? No. Did we, like, did Johnson overturn the executive order 11110? No. What did Johnson change? He kept all the policies are basically the same. We're still in Vietnam. We're still in all. He changed the Middle Eastern policy. Total 180. That was his focus. The first thing he did on the first day in office was dealing with Israel. The first thing Nixon said, too. Nixon, the first thing he wanted to know is, how much do we know about Israel and Dimona? Mm-hmm. And he's the one that started Nickelgrass. And, you know, it was just consecutive Israeli presidents.
And the Vietnam Nixon War was
Johnson, but the mob had him by the short hairs.
In the Vietnam War, one thing it did do is it did obscure, at least distract from, you know, things like the Six-Day War and what was going on with the Israelis were doing in the
Six-Day War. Ed Shackleton had moved their heroin base of operations to Laos, right? Mm-hmm. And Shackley's a station chief in Miami and deeply involved in the JFK assassination. Yeah. He's a CIA guy. But they went, because when they're, as Europe gets, you know, rebuilt, you have a limited amount of time when countries have been blown apart where prostitution, narcotics, etc. are going to be thriving businesses, because that's how people get on their feet. You know, if you're starving and you're a woman, you sell your body or whatever, you're a man and you either rob something or you sell drugs. And so there's a lucrative business. But as Europe gets back on its feet and that French Connection, the heroin, you know, there are two main places, the Golden Triangle and the Golden Crescent, to actually grow opium. And they said, cut out these middlemen. We're getting it from the source. And they went straight to Laos. And you can see the CIA buying up property in Vietnam and Cambodia, Laos area in the 50s, right? Long before the war gets going, before the French are thrown out. The CIA already started buying. The first thing they always get is property, right? So they got their assets to have base operations, and Shackley and them had moved over there and were using the narcotics money. And you could see them, it's the same old story, song and dance, right? But
yeah, this is what Lucian Conan and Danny Ellsberg were doing, right?
Yes.
And then he produces the Pentagon Papers, which puts all the blame on the Pentagon, right, for the war, not CIA.
There's always like an official, I don't know what to call it, misinformation. Like, oh, there's my scapegoat. They don't see the Israeli hand in these things and how much of this money is going to prop up their terrorist state, illegal weapons and arms purchases and stuff, which they use from narcotics trade. Even in modern times, you're talking about like $80 million worth of ecstasy trade to the United States, which was being used for to pay for cyber warfare and illegal arms sales, etc. But when the Israelis get caught spying on the United States or stealing from the United States, nothing really happens. I mean, Pollard went to jail and then got released, but because he did so much damage to the United States that we're not that cucked, you know. But his handlers and stuff, I mean, even on 9/11, you see people just get released. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows. I mean, look at these infamous dancing Israelis. They've got passports and plane tickets to immediately leave the country. to go to places like India and Australia and Germany. Like, wait a minute. So these are some minimum wage or maybe slightly more workers for a furniture company that moves furniture, and they're going to take vacations to India and Australia, things, places like that, yeah. on their salary. And they all decided to leave on the same day, and it's just some random Tuesday in September. It's not like for Christmas or the summer or something. It's like, oh, let's just pick a random Tuesday in September. And lo and behold, that's the exact same day your boss closes his business and flees to Israel. And he's on the FBI suspect list for 9/11. And you happen to be celebrating the attacks, like, and said, oh, we just thought it was an airplane crash. What kind of normal person sees a plane fly into a building? So you know all those people on the plane are dead, and the people that were on those floors are dead. And you're like, awesome. And you start flicking lighters and high-fiving. This is adults, too, not like a kid that saw that. And you just start hugging each other and taking pictures of yourself with it, the fire in the background, because you just think it's so cool that you saw a people die in a plane crash. And then you stick around and wait for a second one, right? Like, because you know that's coming. Their story is so damn ridiculous, and they just got let out of jail, you know? So it's like, you know.
Well, I think at the time, wasn't Chertoff, Michael Chertoff, dual citizen Chertoff, didn't he spearhead the investigation of that?
He's instrumental in it, but it's not just Chertoff. They were just – Israel had such a grip on the United States that they were going to let him go because they had to, because the United States was – it wasn't like Israel did that all by themselves. That whole Safari Club clique, the U.S., Saudis, Israel working together to make sure 9/11 happened the way it did. So
it's a consortium, yeah.
I mean, that's what, when you sort of heard Richard Perl and Mark Grossman and – talk, and I think it was Wolf or someone of those, but there, Grossman and Pearl were overheard talking about FBI 9/11 suspects, and they're saying, we got to get them out of the country before they spill the beans. Wow. And all of this is known. I've put it all out, and it just, it gets lost in the ether of stupid, because it's kind of like the Kennedy stuff where they'll blame the Federal Reserve or something, or in 9/11, there are people who don't even believe in airplanes. And it's just like beating your head on the wall, because you get put into like a camp, and it's just sort of considered on the same level as the people talking about holograms or mini nukes or whatever, you know. And we got them dead to rights.
Weren't the alleged hijackers also being shadowed by Israeli?
Yes, and that's what's so funny is, like, Yaron Shmuel, who's one of the three that was seen dancing around and flicking lighters and things and celebrating, and then who got arrested later in the Urban Moving System van, he's he lived in Florida when Atta lived in Florida. When Atta went to Brooklyn, so did he. I mean, and they're like three houses down. I mean, they were literally right next door to Atta and following him around and making sure the local authorities weren't tipped off on anything. And that was the B team, because if you look at these dancing Israelis, they're not the Mossad. There were two of them, the older one, Paul Kurzberg and his brother, were already on the counterintelligence database, but they're in their 20s. So these aren't seasoned Mossad agents or something that are going to be in, you know, the top tier to be working on 9/11. Which is why they're like the C team, right? They're there to move things in and out of the building, keep your mouth shut, whatever. Not a lot of responsibility. And most of them, you know, behave. But these idiots just couldn't help it. They had a huge party on September 10th because some of the people from White Glove Movers were all at the Sivan Kersberg's apartment. And they had this huge party. And they go there early and ready to watch it, film it, and celebrate. And it was so stupid to go to Doric Towers because other people who lived there just looked out the window and saw what they were doing. You
know? Well, they saw Middle Eastern men celebrating.
Oh, well, she just said men, I think, but yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, there was a couple that lived in Doric Towers who moved out on September 10th and utilized one of these companies to do it. They had maps with that. I mean, come on, there's so much evidence. And that's, I made a film called Empire and Mass that I know you've seen, that
just goes over and overkill. But sometimes when I'm talking about 9/11, people are like, what? Like, they had not heard of some of the most basic stuff because they get lost in Jonestown, you know, and they don't know real simple things. Like, same thing with RFK. A lot of people have heard, oh, 13 shots with an 8-shot gun, but they didn't really bother to look and see who Sirhan's lawyers were. They didn't look to bother and see, you know, who hired a security. And to me, that's like the first thing you should do is follow the money, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's sort of a meticulous, disciplined forensic analysis of the evidence. Even financial evidence will tell you what's going on more than...
All the evidence points to that. I mean, the medical examiners, the coroner, there's burn marks on Robert's head.
Yeah.
There's witnesses that saw someone fire a gun behind him. We know who that someone was. They're all tied to the mob. Da-da-da-da-da. It all fits one story. They all agree. The police, the forensic evidence, yeah, we have more than 8 bullets. Like, that is a fact. We have acoustic evidence where you can hear more than 8 shots being fired. So even though they tore that kitchen apart because it no longer exists and they got rid of the files, there were some pictures from the police, you know, looking at the bullets and things that still exist. A lot of those policemen were still alive after the fact and will tell you, yes, I saw the bullet holes and so on. So they can't cover it up completely. Not in the age of the internet. The only way they can cover it up is to put out a bunch of ridiculous stories so that when you try to find the information, you get stuck in the rabbit hole of disinformation.
Well, you have gray, black, and white propaganda, right?
Exactly.
And it's hard, and it's hard with people looking into this stuff, and it's hard not to be passionate about this stuff. And there is evidence, there is other evidence of media manipulation, you know, like whether it's fakery or, a good example, was it Fox News on 9/11 ran a file video of Palestinians celebrating and said they were celebrating the 9/11 attacks? That is so malicious.
Right.
That
is, and it's
so
like, malicious. Really, it shouldn't be daytime there right now, but whatever. And they're giving peace signs, right? Because people gave them cake and stuff.
Yeah.
And everybody knows if you hold up two fingers, it's a peace sign.
Yeah.
But Fox, they were like, they're doing the V for victory sign. What are you talking about? It hasn't been the V for victory sign in many decades.
But what that means is someone had to tell an intern to go get that file video, put it in the machine, and let's run it. It's not accidental.
Talk about dancing Palestinians.
Yeah. I mean, that's just... Yeah, something like that. So,
and a lot of people turned on Palestine and lost sympathy for Palestine because a Palestinian had killed Robert Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And was motivated by those politics, even though he wasn't. And this Sirhan is a weird dude. I mean, you go through his notebooks and the things he's written, and he's writing about Frank in there and saying, asking him to pay him. Donna Ramos, please give me five. I'm not stuttering. That's actually what he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And he's found with, I think, four $100 bills on his person, which you don't walk around with $100 bills in 68, you know, not most people.
No.
I mean, you look at where he works. You look at who hired him. You look at who represented him. I mean, he's just got mob in every single direction. And they're talking about doing a contract killing. Like, all this comes out. And they have files that the California records just won't release. Why? Which makes you wonder, well, how in charge is the mafia today in these areas of California politics? Because at some point, you think there'd be somebody get in there and look at it and go, wow, we have all this information on these criminal syndicates that did a contract killing on RFK. And lo and behold, it traces back up to the Israelis and so on and so on. That hasn't happened.
Well, I mean, if you look at the power structure of Hollywood in California, people like Lou Wasserman and Jules Steins, they're all mobsters, and they all became, you know, kingmakers. Ronald Reagan. And...
Yeah, the Hollywood mafia is not Italian either.
No, it's not. You know, so this is going to be controlled. And at the end of the day, it's a company town, right? And they're going to protect a lot of these things, and they're going to protect, you know, they have their interest, and... We all know how Hollywood moguls identify with Israel.
They destroyed the hotel.
Well, and they built Robert.
Get rid of the physical evidence, you know.
And they built Robert F. Kennedy High School.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's It really is something else. Just look at the evidence, and obviously what we have a situation where the official story is ludicrous, and then we're stuck with dealing what really happened. And I think at your work,
he's holding Thane's tie in his hand on the ground.
Yeah.
Like, last thing he could do before, I mean, he got shot through the brain, so, but the last thing he did was yank that tie off of him. That's how close he was to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got burn marks on his head. Sirhan was never that close to him and was not behind him.
Right. No witnesses placed him closer than 2 feet. Yeah.
And there were shots. John Pilger, he's from Australia, right? But he's lived in the UK a long time. Phenomenal journalist, was there. And he was next to Sirhan. One of the people who got grazed by a bullet was right next to John. So unless Sirhan's just like firing backwards or something, there shouldn't be bullets going that direction. But someone had fired, and probably the one that went through Kennedy's coat is what that one that hit that person. I mean, but now, like, you can only go off the few pictures that exist of that kitchen area because you can't visit it or anything.
Yeah.
And
you heard the story about Scott Enyart, the photographer?
No, what's that?
High school kid was there filming the day. He was, like, you know, 15, 16 years old, and he, young guy, supported Kennedy, and he was there as a photographer. He was just back in the kitchen shooting, you know, one picture after another, as a lot of photographers do, sort of getting the whole, in hopes of getting a good shot when you shoot so many photographs. He was there standing up on a table, I think, to get a good view of it, shooting these pictures, and of course the assassination occurs, and the police seized this camera. I mean, before they went after, before they questioned Caesar, they immediately went for the camera, and they seized the tape, the film as evidence, and never released the film, and was never submitted as evidence. And then years later, in the 80s, he sues to get it because he realizes it's worth a lot of money. This is the 80s, there's a lawsuit, and the police claim that they don't have it. It turns out, in the terms of, in the process of the trial or the lawsuit, they had to turn it over, and they admitted to having it, and they were about to turn over the film. And the courier, it was like a PI or hired as a courier, to pick up the film, gets a flat tire on his way to deliver the film to Scott Enyart. And that's when the briefcase with the film in it gets stolen. That is the
snake ate it story.
Yes. And remember, that he would have had multiple photographs. And showing us, you know, almost like maybe 50, 60 photographs, almost like shot, showing us what's happening.
It's definitely a cover-up.
And so, I mean, when I heard that story, and the guy, Scott Enyart, won the case, and he doesn't want to talk about it anymore. I've talked to a couple of people who actually know him, says he just wanted to drop it. Maybe he was threatened or something. But
I'm sure someone talked to him.
Yeah, and, you know, the film's lost, so what are you going to die for? Nothing? Because, you know, I think he won because the film's worth something, and with the case being closed, the police can never claim it as evidence, so it's his property.
I'll tell you something. I've been talked to after I did that Eddie Bravo show. I got talked to, and that's why I will not even say some things about certain people in New York, because I want to be able to travel there and stuff, and it's not worth it to me.
Yeah.
Like, I'll talk about the people who are dead already, and I'll give you the mystery, and I'll tell you about Thane and all that, but there's a certain point where I'm just going to, you know, take the fifth.
Yeah.
And so I understand why a lot of people, you know, involved in that didn't say anything or couldn't come forward because they don't want anything to happen to their family or themselves. Yeah. And that's how these mafia work. They will fucking kill you. Like, this is a very serious topic. And I can talk about it because of where I live, but that I'm not immune. They'll come out here.
Yeah.
They can do stuff. There's other things they can do. So you got to be real careful when you're talking about the mob. Now, you can talk about the mob in the 30s and 40s or whatever. Like, that's pretty much been done. And I'm glad people do it, but tread lightly. If you're going to go after current things, you know, be careful.
Yes.
Because they are very serious. The government, too. I'll talk about 9/11 to a point. But, you know, ultimately, I'll, like, basically lead you to water and say, now, you know, figure it out from there, right?
Yeah. Or just, you know, ignore it all and pretend that everything's okay.
They murdered the Kennedys. And I'm not one of these people that romanticizes the Kennedys as Camelot or anything, but they were going after Israel, and that got them killed.
Yeah, and that's you could see it as sort of a fight within the ruling elite, the governing faction. And we talk about who really runs the world and, you know, the global elite and the political class. And you have to there's going to be conflicts and disagreements within this faction, and it's not going to be monolithic. And perhaps the
The Arabs run Hollywood. Alex Jones told us that.
You know, it's like, the
seven of the last 8 Federal Reserve chairmen have been Arab.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Is that, you ever heard sort of like McCarthyism got its start by J. Edgar Hoover, who wanted to embarrass the Pentagon and the newly formed CIA because he saw it as a threat to his power, domestic powers.
And, you know, Hoover was a hardcore racist, mm-hmm, as well, and he was one of these liberal racists where he thought like segregation was good for both people and like rationalizing it and, mm-hmm, things like that. So, and he had deep connections to some of these Birchers and all that and the Klan and everything. And he helped cover up the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hubert. Yeah.
So, well, Ryan, I want to thank you for coming back on the show. Do you want to pitch? You're working on this film. Do you want to pitch it something?
Yeah, I'm sorry I kind of pumped the brakes at a bunch of points, but
yeah,
kind of want to. I don't know. I wanted to present something to just kind of give the audience the gist of it and say, mm-hmm, well, here's all you really need to know, like, without getting drowned in details, because people criticize me saying you talk too many tangents, and so I tried to do it better. But I don't, it's not my style. I like going on the tangents and details, but I will be making a film.
History is one long tangent. So.
It is. It's like, well, that, like, it's hard to, when you're talking about the mob and you're talking about all these syndicates and you're like, well, this guy, we could have talked about a lot of other players, you know, but it's hard. It's hard to do interviews on this stuff because if I'm talking to you or Doug or someone like that, we can just go, oh, you know, SEO, right? And da, 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 da. But then I'm trying to think, no, people don't know that. It's not common knowledge. So I have to name the bank, name the thing. And so I'm sorry if some of you, I don't know. I want to bring new people in. And at the other part of me is like, I just want to like run with it with people who are already seasoned on mafia knowledge or whatever. But yeah.
Sometimes you can focus on a person. Like a good example of how the system works is, it was Clark Clifford, the man who wrote the National Security Act, which created the CIA. And later on, he gets caught up in BCCI.
And, he's in the Empire at Mast.
Yeah. And, right. And a figure like that kind of shows you how it all kind of works. Because he's part of the elite. He's legit, right? He's considered legit. This power broker and, you know, the Truman advisor and these things, who I think he's the one that convinced Truman to recognize Israel. But at the same time, he writes the National Security Act, which formalizes the sort of ancestral relationship between big corporations, organized crime and these things into like an intelligence agency. Prior to that, mm-hmm, it was sort of informal. And at the same time, years later, he's exposed with the BCCI scandal, which is focusing on that bank to kind of tells you how this all works. And that's one
way. They just went from that back to Riggs.
Yeah, the Riggs Bank.
The traditional CIA bank. But I hope people will look into Carmine Galante. Mm-hmm. Look into Frank Dottoramas. It's Donneroumas. It's really messed up last name. But then, of course, there's John Alessio, Grant Cooper, we'll skip Johnny Roselli, and then also Russell Parsons, because if you look into those individuals, those are that's the most immediate ring around Sirhan Sirhan, for example. And I think that will give you a lot of meat and potatoes on Thane Eugene Caesar and what happened to RFK. As for, you know, what's really all behind it, that takes some time to parse out, but if you just want to know what happened without the why, well, Thane shot him in the head. That's what happened.
That's a bumper sticker. Thane shot him.
Thane did it, man. Thane shot first. Whatever. Who cares about Han Solo? Like, people are shocked to be like, whoa, you just gave me the name of the shooter of RFK. I'm like, I can tell you shot JFK too, but you won't know who that is, you know, like without the background and stuff, so it doesn't matter.
Yep. Wasn't it the driver?
No.
It wasn't Jackie?
No. There are people, I get that joke, because there are people saying things like that. Oh, William Greer did it. Yeah, like Jackie is gonna shoot her husband in the middle of a parade in front of everyone. Like, she'd never have any opportunity to poison his food or shoot him. Let's just do it in the middle of a parade.
And
drive him to the hospital.
He was killed because in Pillow Talk with Marilyn Monroe, JFK revealed the existence of aliens, right?
You know what? Mickey Cohen was involved in Monroe's death.
That's interesting. That's
another show. But I think people might find that interesting because there is a Monroe Kennedy connection, and he was banging her, and so much better taste than some of our current than like Lewinsky or something. Although if Trump banged Karen McDougal, I'm like, okay. I'll give you that one, you know. His third wife is nice, but anyway, it's Cohen Monroe. We should just talk about the mafia in Hollywood, like Hollywood's beginnings.
Next time I like to talk.
There's
about
a bunch of stories that I feel like are in my head that I just don't have the energy to go just to get to the point I'm on, you know. So that is something I think that people might be interested in, because especially after Weinstein and all this, I'm just thinking, oh, that's just part of the how it's always been, you know. So, and yeah, this whole Chicago versus New York with L.A. and Vegas, right?
Yeah, that's two books on that. The Super Mob by Gus Russo, which is pretty good, by Sidney Korshak, and the Chicago Jewish Mafia going out the, you know, from Oakdale, Chicago, and going out to California and sort of playing the role as middlemen, becoming powerful in their own right with Lou Wasserman and Jules Stein. And then there's also, what's that book by Decker, Sally Decker, and who's the other journalist, about the power and the money, about Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Very good. There's book. Christian and Turner. There's David Shem too. There's lots of good books on the Kennedys or on the mafia. There's not a lot of good films online or whatever. I've seen films that said there were like 11 shots at Daily Plaza, and you know, just one from the sewer and just retarded stuff. And that's what drove me to make 9/11 films, and why I'm going to do a RFK and JFK film, because it really takes a movie. There's so many names and stuff to remember, and it's just hard without the visuals, but once you put it all together, it's done. And I need to make enough off it so I can stay in Asia.
Okay.
Once George Bush Sr. dies, which should be soon, I'll feel a little safer.
He's pinching.
It really goes all the way to the top, just like Jack Ruby said.
Yeah.
The man at the top, which was LBJ at the time. And he was like, can you take me to D.C.? Because he knew the Dallas police were compromised.
Yeah.
Bill Decker and the rest of it. Can you take me there? I'm afraid of what happens, my people. Like, he was afraid of the reaction that was going to happen to his people meaning Jewish people, if the truth were known. And what you saying there, Jackie?
Yeah. That's right.
I had to do it, you know. I had... Because to save my people. Because Oswald would have told it. I talked to Oswald's handler's son from the Office of Naval Intelligence. He lives on the Outer Banks.
Really?
And had a lot of stuff to say. Mm-hmm. That's exclusive stuff. That's all in my film. Yep.
Well, this is
film. One phone call, right? That's who he calls. He calls Oni. Call a lawyer or anything. He calls the government.
The government, yeah. Now, this is your film on your upcoming film?
Yeah, so I have a Patreon, and I'm like $400 away from my goal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting really excited. I'm getting back into the my Kennedy mood, because I already wrote all these notebooks worth of stuff, and I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to go to Daily Plaza or anything like that. I'm not going to be able to afford it. But it looks like I really can. So I'd love to finish these. It's going to be two films, an RFK film and a JFK film. And I will be talking about both of them in both films, but I thought it'd be better to divide it.
Yeah.
Empire and Mass. Some people love the 5-hour stuff. Some people are like, don't do that again. It took me 3 days to watch it. I'm like, it's a complicated topic.
Yeah, It took me 3 days to learn about how the world works. Really?
I mean, well, otherwise you'd have to watch like 10 little films on it. So I don't know. That's my argument. But I am going to break it up into two films. And for my sake, the RFK one is just easier and more doable and quick, and I'll get it out. But JFK is going to be the coup de grace. And then after that, I don't know. I've been asked, I may make a film about Afghanistan, I think. But I'm really close, and it's taken so many years. I was stuck on Patreon for a long time. And just recently, it's only within hundreds of dollars away. And I'm thinking, man, maybe it could be this summer. Maybe not, but I'm hoping so. And then I can just get on the visuals right away. I'm down for it. I have so much information and organization. I've written it out on paper, exactly how to explain it and stuff. But it's just way easier than just randomly answering things. I wrote out what I think is a very good way to present it, sort of debunking some of the common things first and then sliding into what went down. And yeah, it's going to be Who Killed the Kennedys. Real awesome title, right?
Who killed the
This is Who Killed the Kennedys, they all call it.
Well, it's to the point. No confusion there. So, okay, Ryan, well, thanks a lot. That's Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report. That's ancreport.com, right?
That's right.
Yep. That's his website, and follow his work, watch his videos, support his work at Patreon, so he can continue with his research. And I'll let you go. Thanks a lot. And I'll probably post this in a couple of days. When I do, I'll send you the link. I'm playing my guitar while the sister bangs a jar. The glass sets up a sound like people laughing. It's going to my brain and it's easing all my pain. I must hear this sound again, 'cause time is passing. I'm walking by the sea, the jingle sings for me. The crabs are swimming down among the starfish. The rocks are patted down, seagulls fly around.
Don't hear it.